Jim, one of the challenges of that arrangement is the old higher ground is 3/4 time, and that higher ground is 4/4 time. That was the great challenge, so we were off a bit, but the spirit was good, and we got her done. I am honored that you have come back tonight. I got a nap, so I can do 2 hours of preaching, and it's just, okay, I won't. I promise I won't. But you have a sheet in front of you that I want to walk through. I promise you that I would walk through the entire Gospel of Mark and give you a framework for understanding Mark, and it has a particular lens to it. If you don't have a handout, I don't have slides for the fill-in-the-blanks, so you have to listen close or get them later. But I wanted to kind of walk you through. It's one of my favorite things to do is scope whole entire books of the New Testament in practical ways, if that makes sense. Bruce, it looks like you won tonight. The number of people coming, I guess 30 to 40. I don't know what we have, but it looks like 300 to me. So we're grateful for that. My eyes are really bad, and so I'm grateful that these will be clear windows the next time I come. Right, Brent? Is that what you're looking at? So I do have some cataracts going on, and got one for distance and one for... Anyway, I'm just... that's where I am. So grateful for your presence this evening. Let's pray, and then we'll jump right in, see if we can't get you out before 10 o'clock. Father, we want to be followers of Jesus Christ. God, give us strength, give us resolve, give us wisdom, give us clarity. Help us see the beauty of this gospel, the first gospel that shapes all of history. In the name of Christ, I pray. Amen. So let's just jump right in. If you want to follow Jesus, are you willing to live the good news, which is the gospel, as a participant in God's life rather than being a consumer of religious goods and services? Let's let that sink in. If you want to follow Jesus, are you willing to live the gospel of Jesus Christ as a participant in God's life? Because that's what the gospel calls us to, is to participate in the very life of God rather than being a consumer of religious goods and services. I love this quote from a book called Stormfront. The gospel has less to do with the alleged benefits that might come with believing in God, and more with what God plans to do with those who answer Jesus' call to give up all and follow him. That's a shift. That's a big shift. Because we are used to thinking in terms of the gospel as I need to obey the gospel so I can receive salvation, true, and get all these blessings. But what if you're obeying the gospel to enter a certain kind of life that God already has and already is, and he's going to do something with you as you enter that life. Does that make sense? More than history of Jesus Christ, the gospels are for the church in following Jesus. Now, I ran across a resource recently. We'll come back to that thought in just a moment. That will kind of take care of the next bullet points, framing the story. And so this resource is called the Bible Project. You need to write that down. You can get it online. It's an online resource. And I'm going to introduce you to it tonight because it's great for Bible studies, I think it'd be good for maybe fourth grade up. It'd be good for any adult if you're trying to have a Bible study with somebody or in your home. It's a great online resource called the Bible Project, and it covers... They're short videos that are 5 minutes to 8 minutes long and covers every book in the New Testament, including how to read the Bible, including why we should study the Bible, how to study the Bible. And so I want to introduce you by just simply saying, here's the Gospel of Mark tonight. Keith's going to pull it up, and it's 5 minutes and 34 seconds or something like that, that will frame the Gospel of Mark and save me some time talking tonight. How about that? But it's a great resource. You might want to seriously look at it. He'll get it there in a minute as we look at this.
The Gospel of Mark is a book in the Bible about the life of Jesus. And the earliest reliable tradition tells us that it was written by a guy named John Mark.
Now, Mark didn't just grab a bunch of random stories about Jesus and throw them together. He's designed this book to address some really specific questions about whether or not Jesus was the Jewish Messiah.
So let's stop right there, because that's a term a lot of people like me aren't very familiar with.
Yeah, so the Messiah was a royal figure, sometimes called the Son of God, that Israel was expecting to come and set up a kingdom here on earth. And around the time of Jesus, Israel was occupied by Rome, and so many Jews were hoping that the Messiah would come and overthrow the Romans and rule as king.
But Jesus didn't overthrow the Romans. In fact, he was killed by them.
And that brings us to the very issues Mark is trying to get at in this book. So in the first half, he focuses on who Jesus is. Is he really the Messiah? And then in the second half, he's addressing how Jesus became the Messianic King. And then right here in the middle of the book is this pivotal story that brings the two halves together, and Jesus answers both of these questions.
Okay, so let's talk about the first half of the book, who Jesus is.
So Mark makes his beliefs about Jesus very clear from the first line of the book. The beginning of the good news about Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God.
One of the next stories is Jesus getting baptized, and God's voice announces from heaven, "This is my Son." So it couldn't be more clear. It's presenting Jesus as the Messiah.
Yes, but as you're reading through this first half of Mark, you'll notice something really interesting start to happen. Jesus is going about healing all these different people, and he's constantly telling them to keep quiet about who he is. This happens so many times in Mark's account, it's very strange.
Yeah, why keep it a secret?
So remember, lots of Jews had lots of different expectations about what the Messiah would be and do, and so Jesus doesn't want people to misunderstand what it means for him to be Israel's Messiah. And so with all that in mind, we come now to the pivotal story at the center of the book, where Jesus takes his disciples away and he asks them, "Who do you all say that I am?"
And Peter says what everyone's been saying, "You're the Messiah, the Son of God."
But then something new happens, because Jesus starts explaining to them how he's going to become the Messianic King, and it is not what they expected. He says he's going to suffer and die and rule by becoming a servant, or in his words, "The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to become a servant, and to give his life as a ransom for many."
Peter is startled by this, and he rebukes Jesus because there's no way he's going to let Jesus die. And Jesus responds, "Get behind me, Satan," which is really intense.
It really is. But it highlights how important it is for Jesus that his disciples come to understand who he really is. And so here, now in this pivotal section, Jesus tries three different times to have this conversation with them, and every time they respond in confusion and even fear.
Okay, so this launches us into the second half of the book, where Mark addresses the question of how Jesus becomes the Messianic King. It's the last week of Jesus' life. He goes to Jerusalem, gets in conflict with the religious leaders, and gets arrested.
And he's put on trial as someone who's claiming to be the king of the Jews. He's even given a crown and a purple robe like a king would get, but it is all a cruel joke.
Then he's mocked and beaten and hung up on a cross where he dies.
And it's here in this crucial scene that we meet a new character.
A Roman soldier.
Who suddenly gets everything that's going on.
He says, "Surely this is the Son of God."
Which is crazy. It's an enemy who's first putting it all together that Israel's Messianic King is the crucified Jesus.
That's the structure of the book of Mark. But the book doesn't end with Jesus dead on the cross.
No. So on the third day, some women go to visit Jesus' tomb, only to find that it's empty. And then there's this angel standing there instructing them to go and tell this good news that Jesus is alive from the dead. But instead, they run away and they don't tell anyone because they're afraid. And that's how the book ends.
Which is a really abrupt ending.
Yeah, it's so abrupt that later scribes did add an ending that brings more closure to the story. And you'll find that story in your Bible with a little footnote that says it was added much later. But Mark's a brilliant storyteller, and he's intentionally ended this book abruptly. So all through the book, the disciples have been confused about Jesus' plan to give up his life, the story in the middle, and now right here at the end. It's like Mark is acknowledging just how startling this claim really is. And he wants you, the reader, to wrestle with it for yourself. Is this crucified Jesus really the Messiah that they've been waiting for?
That's well done.
We think the Bible is one grand unified story, and so we're making...
That's one of the producers of it. I really don't know. I just discovered this a couple of weeks ago. One of our partners in Hope Network says, "Hey, look at the Look at the Bible Project, because it's got tons of stuff in there. Old Testament, New Testament, constantly produced. It's free, and you can donate to it if you want. But it is an incredible resource for dialoguing with people, helping people. Whoever did the video stuff, wasn't that great? I mean, all the imagery, it's really good. So it introduces Mark, and what I want to say on your sheet is the framing of the story they pretty much just did before. The way I say it is this: before there was a New Testament, there were merely stories and events that were told and eventually written down. The Gospels, then, are selected stories for earlier followers of Jesus. The first people who heard Mark's story, I want you to get this, were Christians. The first people who heard Mark's story were Christians or disciples. So the events happened. He died around 30 to 33 A.D., but the first people, by the time Gospel of Mark came out in the early 50s, most scholars believe, they were already Christians. So why tell this story? Why write this story down? Because Mark has an agenda. He is a pastor, if you will, someone who's concerned about a specific group of people learning the story of Jesus, but not just the story of Jesus. You know, I grew up and I heard, well, there's four Gospels because it's four different ways of telling the same story, like looking at four different corners of an accident, and you see it from different perspectives. Partially true, but mainly each gospel is written to a particular group of people for a particular reason, and it is to help their faith. So Luke has an orderly account, Luke 1, which the friends speak and Let's Start Talking use to do their stuff. Mark is the first gospel. Most all scholarship in the 20th century had the Gospel of Mark, not Matthew is first, and Matthew and Luke are working from Mark's gospel and adding it. Mark's the shortest gospel. Mark is the gospel of action. And Mark moves quickly. Mark tells. It's the shortest gospel. A lot of people say, well, if I'm going to share the gospel with somebody and talk about Jesus, I like the gospel of John. Well, I love gospel of John, but John's weird. I mean, John is kind of weird. There's multiple levels to work through John. And a lot of the statements we love about Jesus come from John, or from Jesus. I am the way, the truth, and life. I am the door. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life. Well, John makes for great preaching and teaching, but there's a lot of things about John that are just weird. There's no chronological order in John really that much. Half of the book is concerned with 1 week of his life, from John 13 through John 20. And so John's a great book. We love a lot of things in John. For God so loved the world that he gave his only, which is commentary in John. His only begotten Son, whosoever believeth in him shall not perish, but everlasting life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world might have life through him. We love that. It's a parenthetical note if you have an English background. It's a commentary. John's been teaching Nicodemus' story, and then he says, let me kind of summarize this for you. So that's where we get for God so loved the world. John's great. But you know what I do, especially with young people? Who have attention issues, and everybody's in their phones today, you know. I use the Gospel of Mark. I use the Gospel of Mark. And so I want you to understand, the Gospels are written to the church, for the church, and knowing how to follow Jesus. Okay. They lived under Roman imperial power and values. Following Jesus then becomes countercultural in how we use power, what our values are, how we treat people as human beings rather than objects. And Mark is the earliest of the Gospels and reflects the telling of the story from Peter's perspective as a radical manifesto for discipleship. Now, the word radical scares some people. Well, that's just too radical. The word radical comes from the Latin word that just simply means get at the root of. Taproot is the word radical. You're getting at the root of something. So how do I know it's Peter's story? Because you have go tell the disciples and Peter in Mark 16. Many of the events in Mark have to do with Peter that are key, about suffering, about death, about all that kind of stuff. And so Peter becomes the one that probably is the one telling these stories and influencing this. Don't know for sure, don't have a proof text for that. But the phrase, after he's raised from the dead, they go to the tomb, go tell the disciples and make sure you tell Peter. Peter's the one that denied him. Peter's the one that cut off Malchus' ear. Mark tells us all more insight about Peter than anybody else. Go tell the disciples and Peter. Luke doesn't have that. Matthew doesn't have that. John certainly doesn't have that. And so if you think about who Peter is, the Gospel of Mark fits his style. But the Gospels are literature, and they are inspired by the Spirit, but they're shaped for the needs of the church. They're shaped with particular people in mind, and they're formed. They just didn't say, well, I think I'll tell this story and write this story down and write this story. Oh, no. They are formed and shaped in very specific ways with literature. Now, Peter's own faith journey then through the Gospel of Mark reflects the struggle of discipleship we all encounter. And only Mark records that. So they divided. I thought they did a really good job because they agree with me in how I divide Gospel of Mark. Well, that's not true. There's a lot of scholarship to this. But if you think of Mark as three major sections. So you got 1:1, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the good news, the Son of God, all the way up to 8:21. And then you have a central section in Mark from 8:22 to the end of the story of Bartimaeus, 10:52. What's interesting about that central section, we'll come back to in just a moment. And then you have the beginning of chapter 11, actually verse 2, to the end of the book, chapter 16. And then you have in your Bibles, your technical study Bibles, you have verse 9 through 20 are bracketed off in most study Bibles. And they pointed that out. The original text stops at 16:8. But you can't have a gospel that's good news and stop at 16:8 because 16:8 ends with, and they were afraid. Wait, so you got to do something. So they do the addition in the early manuscripts, not the earliest, of 9 through 20 to kind of make it fit, okay? Now, here's what's interesting. You got three major sections in Mark, and there's three major moves. Who is this Jesus? He is the one that has authority over, first of all, he has authority over disease. Mark 1, there's lepers. Mark 2, there's the man with paralyzed. Mark 3, there's the man with the withered hand we talked about this morning. He is the one that has authority. This Jesus has authority over disease. This Jesus has authority over disasters, the walking on the water in chapter 4 following. He walks on water. So he has authority and he calms the sea. He has authority over not only disease, here's another D, he has authority over disasters. He raises Jairus' daughter. He has authority over death, okay? So you got authority over disease, authority over disasters, authority over death. And then early in Mark, he has authority over demons. Demons. Now, in the ancient world, demons resided in lots of places, arid places they went. You remember the story of that Jesus tells? They ran the demons out of the house, left the front door open. The demon went out in arid places and then returned to the house sevenfold. Remember that story? Well, they left the front door open. You know, the demons came back. Is he really talking? What's he talking about there? Well, it's an interesting story that Jesus tells. Demons also resided in the ancient world. The chaos was in the waters of the deep. Now, you see this in the Old Testament, particularly, with the plagues with Pharaoh. Every one of the plagues with Pharaoh matches a god of Egypt. All the plagues match gods of Egypt. So every plague is God, is Yahweh, confronting, the Lord confronting the god of Egypt and winning, the gods of Egypt. So there's the god of the river. There's the god of nature. There's a god, and they had all kinds of names. Now, in the ancient world, the demons resided in arid places, but they also resided in the deep or the chaos or the waters. So when Jesus calms the waters and has that authority, what's really going on there? Whoa, here's a guy that has power over the demons, power over chaos, power over. And so that's why in Africa, when I go to Africa in certain places out in the bush and preach and teach in Africa, Zambia, Botswana, that one of the things you have to overcome is baptism has been resisted in the most illiterate people. For what reason? Guess where the demons reside in Africa? The water. So what you have to do, when I went to Africa, I used the Gospel of Mark, and the missionary told me, he said, now, we're going to preach. You're going to preach probably 8 hours today. We're just going to travel and in a village, sit down, and you start talking about Jesus. But don't ever act like you don't believe demons exist. Now, us Americans, we can kind of, well, it's a psychological, it was back then, but it's not really today. I don't know about that. When I was working as a police chaplain, volunteer police chaplain, I rode some officers. We needed some, it wasn't drugs, it wasn't meth, it wasn't, we went in some places that you just could feel the sense of evil. Gary, where are you? You know what I'm talking about? You just go into some environments, and I went in some environments at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning where there were certain things with a couple of officers, and as a chaplain, and I'm thinking, you could just, it just feels seedy. It feels, you know, it feels like there's a spiritual force at work, and it happened with some people too. And we always say, well, that's just drugs, that's just psychological. The missionary told me in Africa, if you're going to teach the story of Jesus, you got to teach it that you believe firmly in demons. If you act like you don't believe it, they will not obey the gospel or listen to you at all. You lose all respect if you don't take demons seriously in that culture. So I would teach, and I'd start talking about the power of Jesus Christ and the power of Jesus Christ over the deep and over demons and over, and people would start doing, they would get excited. I mean, people in the bush, they would get so excited. They would do this, and they would start going, they start clapping, and they're dancing around. And you're thinking, oh, boy, what's going on here? Are they about to speak in tongues? You know, I'm a Church Christ guy. What's going on? And the missionary would look at me and go, told you. Because they finally have someone that has an ultimate authority and power over the world that they're scared of and controls them. Isn't that something? I'm talking this century. I'm not talking years ago. I'm not talking. And so in the Gospel of Mark, Mark systematically, who is this Jesus? He's the one who has, and you can just follow it the first five, six, seven chapters until the Pharisees kind of get in the boat, so to speak, and they start questioning him and all his violation of traditions. Hello. Okay. Death. He's authority over disease. He's authority over disaster. He's authority over death. He's authority over demons. That's a good way to walk through the first eight chapters of the Gospel of Mark. So what the first question is, who is this Jesus? He is the theme. He is the Lord who has power and authority in the bottom part of the front page of notes, disease, demons, disaster, and death. The second movement is really my favorite in the Gospel of Mark. That's because of the literary way that Mark uses literary cues to understand how he's framing the central issue in the Gospel of Mark, which they talked about, is we move from who is this Jesus to this Jesus is the Son of Man, and it's shown in 8:22 through 10:52. Now, what stories frame that? Blindness. This story always confused me for years. When Jesus had to touch the man, how many times? The second time. You ever wondered about that? Was that because Jesus didn't have power? Or is Mark trying to say something else is going on? I see men walking around like trees, touched them the first time and they could see what? Clearly. Guess what the last story of this section is? 10:46 through 46 through 52 is the story of blind Bartimaeus. And guess how it ends? He sees clearly. The central section of the Gospel of Mark is Mark's way of saying, do you really see who Jesus is really clearly, that he is the Son of Man, that he is not only just Lord over the four D's that we talked about, but he is the way. And there's this little phrase that Mark uses that he says, some versions say, follow him on the road. Other versions says, follow him on the way. He uses it with the first story of the man touched twice. And he uses it with blind Bartimaeus at the end of that story right before the triumphal entry. He follows him on hadas is the Greek word. Now, I'm not a really great Greek student, so I'm not trying to press you with my Greek, all right? Hadas, O-D-O-S, a little apostrophe there. Hadas can be translated physical road, or it could be translated way. It makes so much sense in the central section of Mark that what Mark's doing is saying, are you willing to follow Jesus on the way? On the way where? What does chapter 11 open with? The triumphal entry into Jerusalem. This is so, I've taught this so many times, and I remember years ago discovering this, and my friend Phil Ware, who preached at Austin, Texas, at the Westover Church. Phil and I were preaching in the same town, about the same age. He'd been preaching a little bit longer than me. We used to get together and eat Mexican food in Austin. We'd talk text. And he's the one that said, hey, I've been looking at Mark. I want to show you something from the Greek. He had a degree in Greek. I didn't. He said, let me show you something. Here's this word, Grady. Look where it's used. I went back, looked it up. It frames the central section of the Gospel of Mark, which is the discipleship section of Mark. So all the content between the sandwich between the two blind man stories is the serious content of discipleship. And I've shown it on your sheet on the second page, on the right side of the page, the bookends, 8:22 and 10:46, okay? And so what he's dealing with is the journey to Jerusalem. Now, the Gospel of Luke will say he resolutely set his face toward Jerusalem in Luke chapter 9. That's his discipleship section. Well, set your face toward Jerusalem, it's not about geography. That's a theological statement. What's Jerusalem all about? Place where Jesus is going to what? Die. It's where he's going to be crucified. So to resolutely set his face toward Jerusalem, Jesus is walking straight into the face of death. He knows he's going to have to suffer. He knows he's going to die. He knows that he is going to be raised. God's going to take care of him. Nobody else really does. Jesus still suffers and goes through a lot of pain. So the journey to Jerusalem. Now, in the Gospel of Mark, I did the calculations. It's over 180 kilometers, 111 miles, from Bethsaida to Caesarea Philippi to Galilee, Capernaum, to the region of Judea beyond the Jordan, Jericho, Bethany, Mount of Olives, and Jerusalem. So this physical journey was 111 miles that he went getting to Jerusalem. The content of it is this third move. You move from the Son of Man. Will you go to the cross with Jesus? It's one thing to say, I'm glad he takes care of my demons. I'm glad he takes care of disaster. I'm grateful. He is the authority. He is the Messiah. He is the one. He takes care of all those things. And then Jesus in the central section is saying, will you follow me to the cross? And so the third question becomes, will you go to the cross? And that's where you get the revelation he is the Son of God by the centurion that they talked about on the video. So the little section for me about discipleship, here's the themes. You want to be a disciple of Jesus? The first one is this. Will you suffer? So there it is, your first fill in the blank. Are you willing to suffer in 8:31 through 33, where he talks about the Son of Man will be betrayed, the Son of Man will suffer. The second blank is, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Will you listen to him? That's in chapter 9, verse 7. If you look there, chapter 9, verse 7, all these things come straight out here. This is all the discipleship section. First of all, you got to evaluate, will I just follow Jesus because I get the goodies? Will you follow Jesus simply because you're good? Is there any promise that life is going to be fair once you decide to follow Jesus? Is there any promise that everything's going to be great and you're going to be happy all your life because you follow Jesus? Jesus talks about in the Gospel of Luke, Luke records that Jesus says, you know, there's some families going to be divided because of Jesus. Some of you are living it. Your faith in Jesus is not the same as your partner, as your spouse. Right? Some of you live it every day. Well, if you just pray enough and you're a good enough person and both of you are, you're just going to be happy and everything's, there's no promise in that in following Jesus. Life's not fair. If you want life to be, the fair is about one time a year in Ventura, you know, Texas State Fair. If you want fair, you're not going to get that kind of fair. Life's not fair. Yeah, but I thought if Jesus would take care of all my things, and look at all the evil in the world. besides the quality of life of disciples as being a hindrance to people following Christ, the second one and the greatest struggle, one of the greater struggles is this: what about evil in the world? How does a person with a good intellect go, if there is a God, then why do children have to suffer this way? Why do good people have to die the way they die? Why is it that it seems like the people that are so wicked live so long, and the people that are trying to do right, they get their lives cut short? Those are real, real questions of people struggling with Christian faith. And frankly, I've struggled with those. And frankly, you can see it in Lamentations. There's a struggle there. You can see it in the Psalms. There's a struggle there. That's the beautiful thing about the Bible. The beautiful thing about the Bible is we can teach it in a way that's kind of lofty. But if you really take the Bible seriously, it deals with all the human issues that you need and you experience in life. It's visceral. Some of the Psalms don't end very well. Some of the Psalms have language that are not very nice. Some of the Psalms struggle. And so young people that are struggling with their faith, if you're struggling with your faith and you're a young person, I would recommend the book, If I Really Believe, Why Do I Have These Doubts, by Len Anderson. It's a great book that he wrote for 18 to 24-year-olds struggling with their faith. And he calls himself a congenital doubter. I was born to question. Well, if I'm a doubter, it makes me I don't have faith, I'm not a very good Christian. Wrong formula. Doubt's part of faith. It's okay to doubt. You need a community of faith that it's okay to share what you're thinking and what you're struggling with. Doubt is okay. Don't let anybody tell you if you doubt that you're not a person of faith. That is just not true. And so what you have here is, will you listen to Jesus, 9:7? Will you listen to Jesus? This is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. Will you listen to him? That's what the text talks about. The second one is a third one is 9:14 through 27. And if you look at chapter 9:14 through 27, it's the healing of a boy with a spirit. When they came to the disciples, key word, they saw a great crowd around them and some scribes arguing with them. When the whole crowd saw him, they were immediately overcome with awe and they ran forward to greet him. He asked them, "What are you arguing about?" Someone from the crowd said, "Teacher, I brought my son. He has a spirit that makes him unable to speak, and whenever it seizes him, it dashes him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. I ask your," what does the text say? "Disciples to cast it out, but they could not do so." Watch what Jesus says. He answered them, "You faithless generation, how much longer must I be among you? How much longer must I put up with you? Bring him to me." Now, I think that's kind of the way Jesus said it. You faithless people, bring him to me. I think you see in Mark the humanity of Jesus that's irritated. He's irritated at the lack of faith. Here's my question. Was it toward the disciples or toward the people around him that brought the boy? Jim, I think you could argue both. You could argue either way, right? If you think about it, who's he irritated at? The disciples are the ones that could not cast it out. They're struggling with their faith. These are the same people that watch Jesus do all this power stuff, death, demons, disaster, and they can't do it. So here's the question if you're going to follow Jesus. Will you pray for healing in people's lives, whether they're healed or not? You want to be a disciple of Jesus? Will you pray for healing? Will you pray for physical healing? Will you pray for spiritual healing? And then there's this last one in 9:38 through 41 that I've never cared for because it doesn't fit my framework, but it's there in the Bible. John said to him, "Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he was not following us." But Jesus said, "Do not stop him. For no one who does a deed of power in my name will be able soon afterwards speak evil of me. Whoever is not against us is for us. For I truly tell you, whoever gives you a cup of cold water to drink because you bear the name of Christ will by no means lose the reward. Whew. Can we take this and just scratch this out? I don't like this. This one of the times I don't like this. What's your application to this? Will you acknowledge that God works with, in, and through others besides those in your tribe and of your faith? That God will work however God chooses to work with whoever and wherever there is good going on in the world, regardless of the denominational label or regardless of what? God is present wherever there is goodness in human beings because he's the creator of human beings. I think they're saying, we got to stop this. And we got to stop it because they're not part of our tribe. They're not part of our group, and there's no way they could be doing anything that their motives are wrong. Well, they don't understand doctrine purely. Or they don't. This is convicting to me, who grew up in a heritage that prided itself in being right and biblical. God's at work in ways. I talk to people all the time that never have heard of the Church of Christ in their entire life. They love God. They quote Scripture. They're seeing God. I talk to people. I hear young people at Starbucks talking. I start talking to them. They don't even know what our religious group is. They don't have a clue. What am I supposed to do with that? Nothing. Take them where they are. Love them where they are, and don't take a position of arrogance. That's what I'm saying. Can you accept that God can work with anyone at any time, and it doesn't have to be fit your framework, and God, you're going to let God sort it out in his time, not you? I don't like saying that, but it seems that's what the Bible tells me. Well, he won't lose his reward. Does that mean that people that aren't saved, I can't even go there. I can't even get my mind around it. I'm going to let God do that. Does that make sense? I'm going to let God figure it out. I'm going to let God do it, and I'm just going to take people where they are. I hear stories of people doing incredible things for God, and I'm thinking, wow, they're so far apart from where I am in my understanding of the Bible and faith. How in the world do I make sense of that? I can't. I don't. I just take it where it is. I'll give you a good example. I have several Muslim friends. I'm not scared of them. I don't think they're going to put a bomb in my car. I don't think they're going to blow up my house. I don't think they're after to kill me. They're respectful of my faith. They're very kind. They're embarrassed by the radical Islam. They will have dialogue with me about Jesus. He's a good man, not the Son of God. We differ on that. When I was sick and had some surgery from bladder cancer a few years ago, my next door neighbor is Muslim in Irving, Texas, was. At the house we lived in. Nice people, wonderful people. I didn't make a big deal that the preacher was having bladder cancer surgery. Elders knew, a few friends knew, but I didn't. I told them, don't put it in the church bulletin. Don't send it out on email. You know, being the preacher, the first person to bring us dinner was my next door Muslim friend. His wife brought dinner. They checked on us, checked on me. I was home during the day when my wife went back to work, recovering. I was so humbled by his act of servanthood. And we're not in the same ballpark spiritually. There are stories happening now of Muslims having visions about Jesus Christ. Have you heard this? I know people with Missions Resource Network in Dallas, Fort Worth, Bedford, Texas. Missions Resource Network sends people to the Pacific Rim. They're over there. I've got cousins in Athens, Greece that are missionaries. They're telling incredible stories of Muslim people seeing visions of Jesus. that doesn't fit my rational construct, does it, yours? What am I supposed to do with it? Praise God. I don't know what to do with it. I know this. The story of Mark can engage people at so many different levels. So Mark ends with 11 through 16, the triumphal entry. Mark ends, I believe, on purpose at 16:8. Translators added 9 through 20. It shows it in a good study Bible. It's bracketed off. Here's why. I just don't think life ends real neatly for a lot of people. And I think the life of faith doesn't guarantee you that everything's going to be great in your life. But at the end of your life, as you have followed Jesus, he will give you the strength to get through and get all the way home to him, no matter what. That's why some of the Psalms don't end well. Because life doesn't always end well. I'll close with this. My sister, I have one sister, younger than me, on June 16th, she's been married 26, 27 years, she said, Brian, my husband, her husband, drove himself to the ER, to a dock in the box is what I call him, on a corner, and he was having a heart attack, and they rushed him to a hospital in Oklahoma City, 62 years of age, same age I was at the time. And the doctor said, we're going to immediately put 3 stents in. Brian was raised in a pretty much a non-religious home, a generic belief in God, didn't go to church a whole lot. Basically a good man, worked on an AWACS thing with Boeing at Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma City, computer guy. But for years, he had turned sour and bitter after being let go from American Airlines. He was hard and difficult. They'd had a hard marriage. Fast forward, I went up, saw him, had some visits with him. They put the 3 stents in and said, 50% of your heart's gone on one side, 20% on the other. You are a full-fledged diabetic, and you've been a diabetic a long time. You need to take disability. You're going to have to wear a life vest the rest of your life to shock your heart if you go. You're in bad shape, and there's nothing we could do for you. He was stubborn and prideful and did not go to the doctor for 12 years. My sister told him, you have heart issues. When you vacuum the floor, you're sweating profusely. You drink tons of water. You're diabetic. And he'd yell and scream and holler, oh, I'm just working too hard. It's fine. I'm stressed out. His pride kept him away from the doctor for 12 years. On July 3rd at 10:30 at night, we went. My sister's in the hotel business. And so we got a hotel close to the hospital. We went to the hotel. About 45 minutes later, they called and said he's in full cardiac arrest. But Brian and I had a discussion earlier that day about God, about Christ. I knew he wasn't raised in church. Found out he'd been baptized about 2 years before he met my sister in a Baptist church. We talked. He didn't really know a lot of Bible. But he shared about where his faith was and what he believed about God. I'm going to let God solve all that. How about you? I can't. We walked down that hall, that hospital. There were 10 or 12 people working on him doing heart compressions. Nurses coming out, sweat running down their face. My little sister at 12:30 in the morning, July 4th, said, I got to see him. I said, sister, you don't want to go in there. I've been in there when they're doing heart compressions. You don't want to see this. I got to see him. She took one step in, saw people doing heart compressions, working them. You know what I'm talking about. And people, nurses coming out of there just wringing wet with sweat because they've been doing this for an hour. She said, why did, and she was wailing and hurting so badly. And I held her, walked down the hall with her and said, sis, it's been an hour. What do I do? I said, what would he want? Well, he didn't want to suffer. And I said, and so the doctor comes up and says, Miss King, what would you like? Miss McDaniel, what would you like to do? And she says, what do you mean, what do I want to do? He says, well, you have the medical power. You sign the papers. All you have to do is say stop, and we'll stop. Well, you're the doctor. No, you have to say it. She looked at me, and she said, what do I do? What do I do? And I said, even if they get him to the heart cath lab at an hour of heart compressions, he's probably going to have brain damage. The doctor nodded. The surgeon nodded. She said, well, I said, just say stop. She's weeping. She said, stop it. I can't take it anymore. Of course, he passed immediately. Now, I tell you that story because I don't know where he is with the Lord. I don't have a clue. We used to have discussions. He didn't have a clue about a lot of things in the Bible. But he talked about the experiences he had in his life that pointed to his belief in God and his faith. I'm just going to let God work with it. How about you? It's not my call. So I've been dealing with my sister for a month. Every day I talk to her. And she's putting her life back together. Finding out things that aren't too good that she didn't know. So she's been sad, mad, and glad. You know how I like to say that. But that's life. And a couple of days ago, she calls me and she said, this is a new beginning for me at 59 years of age. I need to start over physically, emotionally, spiritually. Don't leave me, brother. Stay with me. I said, sister, I'm going to be there for you. I just want you to hold Jesus. And here's what I want you to do. As you go to work as the director of sales of a large hotel chain, I want you to read the Gospel of Mark in the mornings for 15 minutes. And about once a week, call me and talk to me about what you're seeing again that you've heard all your life. God, I pray that you would give us wisdom to live well, to reengage a gospel, Mark, Luke, John, as the center of our life and ministry. Grateful for these people here tonight. In the name of Christ, I pray.